Thanks for making Wisconsin Public Radio a part of your day, and thanks for hanging around for Spectrum West, where voices of West Wisconsin's arts and culture are heard loud and clear. The calendar says April, but the view out my window says January. I am appealing to the Persephone, the goddess of spring, to get off her posterior and do her job, which, as I read it, is to be surrounded by flowers and fairies instead of snowbanks and slush puddles. Anyway, this week on Spectrum West, we're going inside the planning of an April 21st fundraiser for Progressive Ideals, featuring the work of artists well known in our neck of the woods. Artists Terry Meyer, Joellen Burke are here, along with Scott Ross, executive director of One Wisconsin Now, coming as the event's keynote speaker. The Inlet Dance Company heads west from Cleveland, Ohio, for an appearance at Eau Claire, UW-Eau Claire, next week. We'll be sharing a conversation I had with the company's executive and artistic director, Mr. Bill Wade. Jim Oliver reports about what's on stage in West Wisconsin, then gets specific, talking with Paul Kallenberg, who's directing the UW Stout Theater production of Big Fish. That opens on Friday. We'll have some Spectrum memos, because it's always busy around here. And speaking of busy, that superbly describes our first guest, B.J. Hollers. Always delightful talking with him. In fact, I should call him whenever I'm having a difficult day, because he has a way of brightening up things, and he consistently has his fingers in or on several things at one time, like a keyboard when he's writing a new book, or in the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, which he originated, or, well, let's talk with him and find out. Well, I had to laugh, because in one of the emails earlier this week, I used the initials BJH, and I said to BJ, isn't that a growth hormone? And it's a little more than coincidental, because BJ looks to be growing all the time. He's teaching, he's writing, he's organizing, and he's unifying. You do give people good reasons to hang out together, like during the Writers Guild retreats. The Writers Guild, actually, was that your brainchild? Is that your deal?
I guess, yeah, it's pretty much my deal, for better or worse, you know, but I think for
it's
the most part.
It's turning out better.
It's turning out better every day, you know. We get more and more people involved, and we just keep widening that pool and, you know, making our mark here.
I brought up retreats. I'm going to hand off the baton, and you go and run with it and give us the history, the success, the present, and the future of these retreats. You've set the schedule for this summer.
We have. This summer will be our third summer at Serenica, which is the name of our writer's retreat in Fall Creek. We have five awesome retreats coming up. The first is with Holly Hughes. She's a mindfulness expert out of Seattle, so really interested in meditation and various ways you can think about writing in an entirely new way. Second up, we have Carla Houston. She's a poet as well.
I've talked to her. Yeah.
You know Carla,
she's
right?
She's interesting.
She's
yeah.
great. She's the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin on top of things, so she's coming up after that. Mm-hmm. Third is Michael Martone. He'll be working on from start to finish on beginnings, endings, and all the words in between. He's actually my mentor, so no one's helped my writing more than he has. He's coming all the way from Alabama to be with us.
Wow. And then does he have an accent?
He does not. He's actually, funny story, he's from my hometown of Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is how I kind of got hooked up with him to begin with, so no accent there.
Okay.
And the final two, of course, we have Nicholas Butler, international bestseller, also happens to live just a few miles outside of where we're doing this. So he's going to be with us again, working on our short fiction. And then last but not least, we have Lindsay Stark, the novelist who wrote Ahab's Wife, who will be with us talking about thickening the plot on creating tension and suspense in fiction.
So, retreats. What are the physical details? You get there when? You leave when? What do you do?
It's
good food?
You bet good food.
I've been there once, and I had good food.
We feed people well. That is one thing we can guarantee. Basically, what happens is you arrive on a Thursday afternoon in the summer, around 4 o'clock. You get there. We hang out that night at campfire, maybe some ping pong, maybe some kind of get-to-know-you exercises with the writer in residence. Then you work hard on Friday and Saturday. Oftentimes, the mornings are more for free writing. The afternoons are more for workshop, one-on-one
sessions.
Now,
when you say work hard, are they going to have to chop wood? Or this isn't physical hard work.
Well, for liability purposes, there will be no chopping wood, I assure you. Okay. No, you're there with your laptop, you're there with your pen and your pencils, working in a group. And that's actually the most magical time for me, is walking in the door to see 10 people quietly at work on their writing. It's a beautiful thing to see. And then we have our meals. This year, we're excited to have Forage on board. So Forage will be coming out there every day, feeding us very well. And we also have some libations courtesy of the Brewing Project. So that's not going to hurt things either.
No, not at all.
And the retreat ends Sunday afternoon. Saturday evening, we have a great big reading open to our friends. And so it's kind of a way to celebrate all the hard work that took place throughout the week.
How do people get involved and who should get involved? What's been your cross-section over the last year or two?
To answer the first question, it's pretty simple. You go to cvwritersguild.org and okay. just click on retreats. And from there, it'll show you the lineup this summer. You click on apply now and you throw your hat in the ring. It's pretty simple. As for who should do it, when I think back on the last few summers together, the best retreats have been this incredible cross-section of folks who are beginners and professionals, people who are 21, people who are 80. You know, a lot of retired folks come out for the first time thinking, you know, I've wanted to write this novel my whole life. Now's my chance. And this might be your chance. The part that you can't get anywhere else is the fellowship. You know, you can sit in a room and you can write till your fingers fall off and maybe you'll get some good work out of that, but you'll still miss the community building. So being able to stay up late, sit around a campfire, have a beer, talk about your day's work and what's coming, that's really where the magic happens.
In the studio with BJ Hollers, educator, author, organizer, coordinator, instigator. And we have already covered the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild Summer Writing Retreats, and we're going to move on now to a new book that has been released or is about to?
Just about to.
Okay, just about to. It's called The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Writers. And this is almost another in a series. You've become quite a voice for the history of struggles with race in America's South. The Freedom Writers, who were and who are they?
Well, in the summer of 1961, folks, both black and white, got together, got on these interstate buses to test a couple Supreme Court rulings. And okay. so as they were riding throughout the states, they were often met with violence, with firebombings, and many of these folks were actually imprisoned in Mississippi for a while as well, all in an effort to, again, test those Supreme Court rulings and hopefully make some meaningful changes.
The moment I opened the book, there I was facing someone who is from the part of Wisconsin I'm from, a guy from Appleton, one of the Freedom Writers. I wanted to get to know this guy.
And that's where the book began. Jim Zwerg was his name. And not only does he have an Appleton connection, but an Eau Claire connection. He was actually a pastor at First Congregational Church, assistant pastor, actually, from 1968 to 1971. And so the story there is, you know, most of the people, most of his congregants never even knew what he'd done. But, you know, I talked to him last week. He's still doing very well and thinks fondly of Eau Claire.
Wow. There is, BJ, a very media-visible black and white divide still today. Police shootings have brought it back to the foreground. Activism was a way of life back in the 60s. The March for Our Lives has rekindled a facet of American life that many people believe defines democracy. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That's the quote. Books like yours are important tools for remembering the past. Do you have that underlying intention in writing stuff like this, or are you simply telling interesting stories and biographies?
Well, I hope to do just what you said there, you know, and for me, this book was actually a little more personal in that it involves a road trip. You know, essentially, I got in the car and retraced a portion of the Freedom Writers route by car, knocking on doors, talking to as many of the original writers as I could.
And you've done that kind of research for other books as well. You kind of like road trips.
I like
you?
The road trip.
Did you take the family along?
This was just a solo trip. Okay. And thank goodness, you know, because it required a lot of knocking on doors, a lot of late nights. But it was the most moving experience I've ever had. I mean, having the chance to sit next door to the Dr. King's house and talk to his former neighbors about, Dr. King used to always walk down the street with his pool cue here and he'd get his haircut right there. I mean, there's a whole history we don't even think about sometimes. And so being able to get to know the people who, in fact, were the people doing the protests and the demonstrations or who knew them well, that was a real honor.
Did the people you meet tell you that they appreciated what you were doing?
Yeah, for the most part. The best part about all of this is getting to befriend people. And, you know, I pick up my phone sometimes and there's a Freedom Writer on the other end. Maybe wanting to talk about, you know, current race relations, things they saw on the news. And there's one Freedom Writer who really has guided my understanding of issues related to race and activism. And his name is Charles Person. And he spoke to a group of students when I was visiting. And he said, you got to ask yourself one question. What would you get on the bus for? And I think about that line all the time because he was asking is, what would you be willing to risk your life for? And it's an important question today.
Do these Freedom Writers get together? Or do they have reunions? Do they keep in touch?
They do. A lot of them do. And in fact, when I was trying to arrange this trip, I realized a lot of them couldn't meet with me during the time in late May when I wanted to meet, and I didn't know what was going on. And then one of them mentioned, well, we have our reunion that weekend. So all I had to do was go to the reunion at the Freedom Writers Museum in Montgomery, and I got to meet a lot of the folks all in one fell swoop.
Are many of them still politically active?
Some. from the people I talk to, they are very much engaged in the current climate and concerned. And, you know, a lot of folks said things like, you know, I fought for this 55 years ago, and I'll be fighting until my dying day.
Yeah, that's something you don't give up normally.
No, I think when you're in, you're in.
That commitment stays. The Roads South, name of the book, Personal Stories of the Freedom Writers. All right, let's get to chapter 3 of the B.J. Holler's radio memoir here, the podcast. It's called Bend in the River. How does it work?
It's a joint project between the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild and Blue Gold Radio with some support from the Eau Claire Community Foundation.
Make my job easier and simply tell us about
it. Bend in the River. Basically, it took us 17 months to write this thing, to get the actors on board, to get the producers on board. And now we're really excited that after all that hard work, we've got a really cool story. The short version is it's a story of a town called River Bend, Wisconsin, which may or may not be Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And a young man named David Sunby, 25 years old, is going back home for his grandfather's funeral when he learns the bridge is out. And so a ferry driver has to come out of retirement to help him cross the river. Mm. And when he gets to the other side, he's transported to 1958, where he's thought to be a Soviet spy. And that's when things get really fun.
Wow. Now I want to listen. Holy moly. How do we get the podcast?
Sure. Well, if you have any kind of podcast app on your iPhone, you probably do. It's that purple button. Just type in Bend in the River and then click on subscribe, and it'll come right to your phone every week. Comes out every Friday on Blue Gold Radio. So every Friday night, the last 2 weeks, I've been gathering in living rooms with some friends, and we're all listening to the final product. And we're going to have a live performance of the final 2 episodes at the Metro on May 5th, and those tickets can be purchased also at bluegoldradio.org.
A good pen name for you could be Greg Arias.
Precarious. That could be a good pen.
I think you should do, right? You should write a book under Greg Arias. Backtracking to the book, it's not out yet, but when it is, how would we get that?
Sure. It'll be available at all local retailers, online, and I have a reading at the local store on May 10th at 7 p.m.
B.J. Holler's always a pleasure to have you here in the studio.
Thanks so much for having me, Al.
Spectrum West on WPR. Next, Jim Oliver looks at Big Fish, a production of UW Stout University Theater. Also, what's on stages all over western Wisconsin. And later, we'll get to know Inlet Dance Company and hear about being progressive artistically and politically. Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona. Collections comprised of art inspired by water from European and American masters, including Picasso, Audubon, and others. More about the museum at mmam.org. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. The Heidi Center for the Arts welcomes Barinya, Russian dance troupe, Monday afternoon, April 9th, 2 p.m. The dances and the costumes are amazing. Then Friday evening, April 13th, it's Jig Jam, the award-winning music quartet from Ireland. CVCA.net, that's the website there. Well, the Polytechnic University also has its artistic, entertaining side. Not that engineering and design aren't entertaining, but the kind Jim Oliver is about to share will omit song and dance again very shortly.
Big Fish is a musical with music and lyrics by Andrew Lippa and a book by John August. It is based on Daniel Wallace's 1998 novel Big Fish, a novel of mythic proportions, and the 2003 film Big Fish. University Theater at UW-Stout in Menominee is staging Big Fish at the Harvey Hall Theater at the University, opening on Friday. Joining us to talk about the play is the director and University Theater director, Paul Collenberg. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you.
So what attracted you to this play?
Well, I remember seeing the movie. I just fell in love with the movie. And when I heard that they were doing turning it into a Broadway musical, I was very anxious for it to be released to the general public to produce it. Once it was made into a musical, I immediately fell in love with the beautiful score, and I thought it was beautiful storytelling, and knew I needed to direct the production of it.
Well, it's billed as family-friendly. Some of the information you sent over in advance says it's about a father and son who go fishing. Anyway, what's the play about?
Well, it really does center around about a father-son relationship, and they're diametrically opposed in terms of their viewpoints of the world. The father, Edward, is an optimist, believes in living life to its fullest, getting out there on the road and grabbing every opportunity that life sends your way. And his son, Will, is more of a pessimist, kind of carries a chip on his shoulder. And those two conflicting philosophies are the basic premise of the show. And, of course, through the show, or by the end of the show, the younger son has the revelation and understands what his dad's stories and fables and viewpoint of the world are and adopts them himself.
Yeah, getting back to this family-friendly business, what would be an age level where they would begin to understand what was going on?
Well, I would say that young adolescents, certainly, it's a musical of fables and stories and magical things happen. And I think the general spirit of the show would reach a wide range of ages.
Mm-hmm. Talk a bit about the music and the musical director, if there's choreography and all of that stuff.
Sure. Andrew Lippa wrote a beautiful score. The play takes place in Alabama, so there's certainly a southern twang to some of the music, some bluegrass type of things, some of your typical Broadway brassy type of stuff and big production numbers, and really some of the most beautiful ballads, I think, written for musical theater are in the show. It's just a great variety of music, great production numbers and dances, and lots of magic happens.
Mm-hmm. Who's your musical director, your choreographer?
I also do the choreography. Musical direction is by Michaela Gifford from Menominee, Wisconsin. The scenic and lighting designer is Associate Professor of Theater Jennifer Sansfaken, and our beautiful costumes are designed by Barb Weisenberger, who is from Eau Claire. Interesting fact about it's a huge show, and so there are over 350 costume pieces that have been put together for the production. So it's been quite a task for our costume shop to put all that together.
Oh, my. Is there an educational component for the student actors in the show?
I think every theatrical experience becomes educational for student actors. Mm-hmm. I think for this show, the particular thing that was most challenging for them was the different storytelling techniques, and we're going backward in time, and then we come forward in time, and really delineating the different time periods and the different characteristics of these individuals in that specific time period.
Uh-huh.
Because there's such a change that goes on in some of these characters, and they're flipping back and forth between where they are, not only physically and in time-wise, but also psychologically.
We are talking to Paul Kallenberg, director of the musical Big Fish, which is being produced by the University Theater at UW-Stout in Menominee. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the theater facility itself. I've been living in these parts for the last 15 years or so, and there's always been a pretty vibrant theater program going on at Stout. Harvey Hall Theater reopened in 2011. After a renovation, and then again in 2016 after a renovation of the 100-and-some-odd-year-old Harvey Hall. Talk about the facility now that it's been renovated a couple
sure.
of times.
When the theater renovation took place, it was a major $6 million renovation. So it was really turned into a state-of-the-art theater. We've got all the bells and whistles and equipment that are in contemporary modern theaters. We also paid close attention to the audience. Seats are very comfortable, wider than normal seats, so there's plenty of room. We increased the space in the aisles, and so the comfort of the audience was of utmost importance. So one of the things we also did was the balcony was tore down and moved back a couple seats to increase the sight lines in the balcony area. After the renovation was done, Harvey Hall Theater was also put on the League of Historic American Theaters registry, so it has a historic significance. And the renovation also kept in mind its historic nature and renovated it back to the look, approximate look of 1916 when it was originally built.
Uh-huh. Now, getting back to the play itself, it's a pretty good-sized cast.
Yes, we have 19 in the cast, ranging all the way from seniors who are graduating down to a local young talented gentleman who's 12 who plays the young son in a number of the scenes.
Well, how does the theater at a technical university fit into the programming?
Well, it fits in very well. We do have a performing arts minor on campus that we recently added, and that's populating very well. There are so many students on campus who have done some type of high school or community theater, and they find their way to Harvey Hall Theater and continue their participation in the arts. We also get a lot of people who have never done theater and find their way here as well, especially some of the people in engineering, industrial design, construction management. They find out that they can come and help build a set and do lighting and work on projects and get credit for it. And then they tell their friends and they keep coming as well.
There are a number of different cast members, but who are the primary actors in the show?
The lead character of Edward is played by Gus Johnson. He is one of our graduating seniors. He's played Horton and Seussical, The Snail and Frog and Toad, and Black Stash and Peter and the Starcatcher. He's just a great, great talent. His son, Will, is played by Kevin Pezel. He also is one of our graduating seniors who has been in every show that we've done here since he arrived 4.5 years ago as a young freshman. So those are the two major characters. Some of the other characters that fill in, Lois Castle plays the witch, and she has been tremendous talent for us, Normal Heart, and in Seussical, she played the Sour Kangaroo.
Now, how many shows during the year do you perform?
We do two shows. We do a production in the fall and then a production in the spring.
Have you picked the fall one yet?
No, we haven't picked the season for next year yet. I'm in the process of it. Uh-huh. It's always kind of a long process trying to figure out what fits into what we've done recently. And last semester, we did The Normal Heart, which was a very serious show. So we're looking more towards a comic show for the fall.
Uh-huh. Well, we've been talking to Paul Kallenberg, director of the musical Big Fish, which opens Friday and Saturday and runs next Thursday through Saturday at the Harvey Hall Theater at the University in Menominee. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mr. Jim Oliver, ladies and gentlemen. And hey, I hear you asking what's on stage in West Wisconsin. Well, before he leaves, Jim has all you need to know.
Thank you, sir. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Charlotte's Web Friday through Sunday at the State Theater. Once Upon a Mattress, a fractured fairy tale musical comedy, will be performed Friday and Saturday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Don't Hug Me, We're Family will run Fridays and Saturdays at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will run through May 19th. The Clear Lake Community Theater will present The Addams Family Friday through Sunday and April 13th through the 15th in the Clear Lake Community Center. The Spring Valley Stagehands Theater will present The Drowsy Chaperone, April 12th to the 15th, the 17th, the 19th, and the 21st to the 22nd. The Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson has scheduled auditions for The Red Box, a Nero Wolfe mystery based on a novel by Rex Stout, for 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday and 7 to 9 p.m. Monday at the Phipps. And the Great River Road Theater will hold auditions for The Music Man from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Sunday and Monday in the Prescott Middle School Cafeteria. I'm Jim Oliver for Spectrum West.
The artist series at UW Eau Claire, rounding out its 53rd season, welcomes entertainment of a wide variety and certainly distinguished in reputation. Last autumn, we talked with actor and comedian Lauren Weedman during her City of Eau Claire show. Since then, the series has featured two music groups with international standing. And next week, Inlet Dance Theater treks from Cleveland, Ohio to Eau Claire to perform. It's an innovative troupe with a commendable mission. The company's executive and artistic director is Bill Wade, a Wisconsin product. We talked by phone earlier this week. My problem is choosing guests who are so darn interesting that they generate so many questions and I can't possibly fit them all in the time allotted. On this show, I certainly want to give our audience a preview of the program coming up next week, but Bill Wade's accomplishments and philosophies are so impressive that we simply have to touch on a few. So welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio and congratulations on an impressive career to this point.
Thank you. I have been busy.
I read up a bit on modern dance, and I was looking for a definition when I discovered that it has been around 100 years or more.
Yes.
And was a reaction to the formality and the rigidity of ballet. So, so by way of a definition, can it be said that modern dance has been redefined over and over and over again?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I was just having this conversation recently when I was in Texas adjudicating for ACDA. You know, ballet, the most prevalent sort of, you know, concert art form in America, and that has everything to do with the fact that it is a European art form, and because most of this country has been founded by people from Europe, that was brought over. But then at the same time that we were thinking about, like, well, what is going to be American music? What is going to be American literature? What is going to be American painting? Of course, we, you know, looked at the art form of dance, and the same thing happened. And because it is in response and reaction to oftentimes previous cultural forms, like ballet is really a cultural form from Western Europe, we're constantly redefining what it is that we call American modern dance.
Now, your dance company, Inlet Dance Theater, is known far and wide as a group of people with a mission, or maybe it should be described more accurately as a small truckload of missions. You you entertain, you educate, you uplift, you empower.
Yeah.
Is there one calling that best describes all the things you guys do or want to do or be known for?
You know, if you kind of look at all of the activities the company embarks on, and you're right, there's a lot. It really, underneath all of it is the driving mechanism in the context of a culture that often uses people to further dance. We have turned that on its head, that Inlet uses dance to further people. We see what we're doing as a way to serve. I mean, it's a privilege to be a choreographer for a living, for example. It's a privilege to be able to, like last couple weeks ago at the Ohio Theater here in Cleveland, do a world premiere of a huge project. So we see what we're doing, which, you know, is not an easy thing to do for a living, as a way to serve people, whether it's, you know, the Boys and Girls Clubs here in Cleveland or private schools or universities or at the theater itself. All of our activities kind of fall under this idea of using dance to further people, getting involved in the training and performing and critical response to performances and things can definitely be used as a way to open people's paradigms and get people involved in sort of growth mindset.
You encourage those who might never realize the power of dance to try it.
Absolutely.
Youth at risk. I even read there were some athletes in there, et cetera. Because it's good for us, inside and out, top to bottom, can you provide a Cliff's Notes description of why it's so nourishing?
Well, I think there's an immediacy in this art form. It's physical, so your body and its movement is the medium that the art is made out of. Because of that immediacy, problem solving and task solutions and everything we create is created collaboratively. For example, it's the things that people learn in that environment transfer to almost everything else in life. I mean, we were joking literally yesterday, rehearsing the concert that we're going to do next week there on campus, that, you know, everything I needed to learn in life, I learned at the dance studio.
Wow. On the phone with Bill Wade, he is executive and artistic director of Inlet Dance Theater. They are coming to UW-Eau Claire as part of their artist series next Thursday, the 12th. Do you think, Bill, dancing is innate? I mean, we almost dance as soon as we can walk, especially when Mom and Dad are videotaping us.
Yeah, exactly.
Then what happens after that? Is it innate?
It is. It is just the human, you know, and I've been blessed to, perform and teach and travel really all over the world because of this modern dance thing. And, you know, if you were an alien, no matter where you landed on this planet, human beings are dancing there.
Sure.
It looks different because of the cultural upbringing and other constructs, but it is literally a just innate human attribute to dance, to express, to move the body, to express. It's almost pre-language, really.
Now, dancing and music have always been kind of like peanut butter and jelly. Is
absolutely
the basic way that we think about dancing, the two together. Mm-hmm. Is it a necessary relationship, especially when learning how to dance?
Nope. And what's interesting is, like, we have a very specific old school American modern dance technique called the Eric Hawkins technique. It's a release technique that we do every morning. And the very beginning portion of class, all of the floor work, whoever's teaching, you know, would be me next week in Wisconsin. Like it is at our home studio, I call out things. There's no music involved in the whole beginning of the class. And then once we get up to standing, we start adding the elements of dynamic range and music, and that's specific to Inlet, really. But I've worked for a lot of choreographers when I was younger and still dancing, because I was blessed to have a 20-year performing career, and I did plenty of work in silence. So they're not necessarily connected. I happen to have my music background as well, so I love connecting the two. Everything that we're going to be doing, well, no, that's not actually true. There's a section of one of the pieces that we're bringing that is done in silence, because the breath and the sound of the body moving and the ropes whipping in the air create its own score in one of the movements of one of the pieces that we're bringing.
I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Kobe Yamada?
Yeah, Kobe Yamada.
Okay, and that's the wonderful premiere in late March that you talked about. You and he and others recently premiered the results of your collaboration, having put his popular children's book, What Do You Do With an Idea, to dance. On this program, I, Bill, talk to songwriters and poets and authors and artists. I like to hear what their process is. And so I'm asking, what is the process, your process, of choreographing? What's involved in turning something like a kid's book, for instance, into a dance production?
There's sort of phases that we go through. Once we have discovered, here's the inspiration, and sometimes the inspiration, like in this situation, was to meet a very specific need. I will first respond to a perceived need that somebody has or I'm noticing in our society. Then there's the research and development phase, and part of that is just, you know, good old-fashioned research, get online, go to the library, that kind of thing. But then we come into the studio when we start to figure out, what of this topic do we know that we can represent with our brand of aesthetic in the company? We're definitely not a ballet company. We climb on each other. We make shapes that morph and change and traverse the space. And we try to figure out how can we represent what is being said through movement. And then each piece in our repertory sort of has a world unto itself. And it takes a certain type of dancer that can not look like that same dancer in every dance. You really have to climb into the world of each piece. And there's acting values involved. There's musicality that's very strong. But we literally, like with the book, the protagonist in the book is a child. How does the child move? Really studying the line quality of the drawings the artist did. And then what is this world? And what happens between this page and the next page? You know, what is the subtext underneath each of these pages and underneath each of these drawings? Having the visual references and understanding what goes on in an artist's head before you put the pen to the paper, it really is the same creative process. Sometimes you're listening to the material itself and allow it to speak to you.
That's Bill Wade, executive and artistic director, Inlet Dance Theater. They're performing next Thursday, the 12th of April, UW Eau Claire Artist Series. As I said, there's so much stuff even in the bio that was sent. I would love, for instance, to see an urban nutcracker. You know, that caught me by surprise pleasantly, and I thought, man, I can just imagine what an urban nutcracker must look like.
It was awesome.
Someday, you've choreographed for figure skaters.
Yeah.
Just done a ton of stuff. Is there anything you don't do?
Choreographically, probably not. I love a challenge, and I literally, every time I start a new work, I challenge myself not to repeat the same process. I want to make sure that the process is connected to the actual topic being developed as well. The book project, What Do You Do With an Idea, we took 3 years to develop that piece. So
Wow. When
you're sitting in the audience and you're watching it, you get a sense of, man, time has been spent inside of this world. This is thick.
Mm-hmm.
The culture of what I'm seeing on the stage is very, very thick. Like the pieces that we're going to bring, you know, next week.
The photograph of you on the bio, I want one of those T-shirts. How do I get a men dance T-shirt?
men and dance T-shirt.
Yeah,
I was a guest. The company was, we were guest performers. I have a whole collection of my work because, you know, I'm kind of a dude. so a lot of my work in the company, and the audience will definitely see this in Eau Claire. There's entire sections that we're doing. It's just the men, and we're very athletic. We're very kind of rough and tumble on the edges, you know.
Yeah.
We definitely take risks, and it's very exciting. But I have an entire collection of the repertory in the company that we affectionately refer to as our dude art collection.
Oh, cool.
On men's topics and things. So one of the sections is called Three Men, and it's definitely an audience pleaser because the lifts are like, how are they doing that? And that's really, really fun because of the fraternity that brings when you're creating these things together.
Sure.
For example, so we were guest artists out in Seattle at the Men and Dance Festival more than one time. And each time I went, I got a Men and Dance T-shirt.
Okay. I'll have to go to that website and get my own. Maybe I'll just draw my own. Who knows?
Yeah.
Mine would have to say old man in dance, though.
So I'm getting there. Yeah.
I'm one of these guys that looks at modern dance and goes, okay, I'm trying. You know?
Our work is pretty accessible, actually. And that's a comment that we get no matter where we are in the country. Like, I don't know about this modern dance stuff, but I love that. You know, and people are like, I actually understood that.
Yeah, I mean, just the term. I mean, it would be nice if somebody coined a new 2018 term that might not put people off who think they know what it is.
Yeah, contemporary dances.
Yeah, okay.
Very
cool.
Common.
Well, everyone's looking forward to your performance and your arrival. Bill Wade, thanks so much for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Absolutely.
Travel safely. The Artist Series is very well known for having just the best stuff.
Yeah, I was perusing it earlier today on the internet. I was like, wow, they're bringing some really cool stuff. So we're very, very excited about visiting and serving.
And, you know, we've all heard the line, dance like nobody's looking. Well, these folks want you to look, and look closely, because their dance has something to say. The show is next Thursday, April 12th, UW Eau Claire Gantner Concert Hall. Tickets available at the Service Center and online at uwec.ticketforce.com. You might want to check them out at their own website, Inlet, I-N-L-E-T, dance.org. Hey, support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota with the all-wheel drive RAV4, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or MarquardtToyota.com. This is Spectrum West on WPR. It stands for Wisconsin Public Radio, in case you're new. Well, arts and activism, if nothing else, they share a certain kind of spirit and desire for transformation. It's no surprise, then, that they periodically merge and feed off each other's energy. That will be the case Saturday, April 21st, when Eau Claire County Democrats and Progressives host a fundraiser that features art, artists, and activists. To hear more, we welcomed artists Joellen Burke and Terry Meyer and Scott Ross, Executive Director of One Wisconsin Now, an organization that carries the progressive banner in our state. Scott, we don't have time to get very nuanced, but we're going to talk brass tacks. First of all, condolences on the loss of your friend and colleague, Peg Lautenschlager. She was the first lady attorney general of the state of Wisconsin. I read your association with her. But, you know, maybe we can memorialize her by using her as an example of progressive values. Maybe she can help define One Wisconsin Now in a way. Your background, Scott, is in communications. You've been listed as both provocateur and watchdog. So if you would, please define for our audience what you do and where you do it.
Sure. Great to talk to you, and great to talk to folks from the Eau Claire area. I run One Wisconsin Now. We are a progressive advocacy organization. And yes, I've been called provocateur. We've been called a watchdog. We've been called liberal muckrakers, which I kind of like because I used to be a reporter. But basically, you know, our job is we want to make sure that progressive ideas, values, and policies are in the public policy debate. And so ways that we do that are we try and find out information to be able to move the debate forward. We sometimes will find out things that we find unsettling that people have done or said, and we try and amplify those in the media. But overall, we want a Wisconsin with equal economic opportunity for all, and that involves a few simple things. One is that if you want to go out and vote, you should be able to vote. And so we work a lot on voter protection. We work a lot on ensuring that the right to vote continues to remain sacred despite encroachment. And, you know, we've actually had to go to federal court and try and undo some of the laws from Governor Walker and the Republicans, which we've been successful in doing. Like, for instance, if you went out and early voted in the election for Supreme Court or your local municipal elections, that was in large part because we won a federal lawsuit that restored early voting to the state of Wisconsin. Another issue that we care about deeply is the student loan debt crisis issue. And here in Wisconsin, we have about a $25 billion student loan debt crisis. We think that you ought to be able to refinance your student loan like you can a mortgage, and that would help, you know, here in Wisconsin, over 515,000 people have immediately lower student loan interest rates at absolutely no cost to taxpayers. Those are some of the issues. And again, like you said at the beginning, you know, we did lose, you know, one of my heroes, the former Attorney General, Peg Lautenschlager. I had the great fortune, great honor to be her communications director on that race, and I had the luck to get to walk over to her and say, hey, looks like you won the election. And so, like, I will take that with me, you know, as long as I am here, because that was certainly one of the highlights of my life, if not just politically, but the 48 years I've been on this mortal coil.
You are from originally Pennsylvania. Wisconsin, once the proud home of progressives like Bill Proxmire and Gaylord Nelson. What has changed?
Well, I think a couple things. There was a wave election in 2010. The Republican money machine exponentially increased its investment in places like Wisconsin, and they swept the table and won every single election that was contested here in the state of Wisconsin at the state and federal levels, and, you know, knocked off Russ Feingold the first time. So that was a huge wave election that allowed them to, you know, go in and write maps in secret, which turned out to jerry-rig the process. You know, they made impenetrable legislative districts for themselves. And then they have taken the power that they have and inflicted punishment upon their enemies. First and foremost, the 175,000 working men and women who Governor Walker stripped away their rights is the first controversial thing he did with Act 10 back in February of 2011.
The change actually means guys like you have a little bit harder job than you once did.
Well, I mean, I'm a desk jockey. My job isn't made harder or softer by what Scott Walker and the Republicans do, or the Democrats for that matter. You know, there are actions that are hurting a lot of people who are really in need all around the state of Wisconsin. Again, I pointed out that I come from western Pennsylvania, the steel capital of Pennsylvania, and my dad was a steel worker, and we literally had a nuclear bomb dropped economically in the entire community in and around everywhere where I lived. And I remember when we waited in line for butter and cheese with the other families in the neighborhood. And the idea that those hardworking men and women who, through no fault of their own, were standing in that line trying to get government cheese and government butter, and that a guy like Scott Walker is now drug testing poor people, essentially saying, we think that before you can get public assistance, you have to prove you're not a criminal, is obscene in a way that makes me actually stand up right now and be angry.
Ah, your desk jockey thing is now you're standing up. Good for you. The words progressive and Democrat are linked. Here's a definition of progressive that I found. Favoring or advocating progress, change, improvement, or reform, as opposed to maintaining things as they are, especially in political matters. But since our program, Spectrum West, deals with arts and culture over politics, let's talk about being progressive and the arts. The four words within that progressive definition also define, in a way, the artistic process: progress, change, improvement, and reform. Artists are seldom satisfied with the status quo, are they, Terry?
Never. I think that as artists, that's what we look for. We look to change. We look to keep growing. Artists are empathetic and often feel the change that the average person on the street is feeling and portray that. You know, there's a reason why the term starving artist is so popular, is because that's usually because I think artists identify more with working people, with people who don't have great means, and empathize with that and express it through our art.
Joellen's here, Joellen Burke. She's also an artist, on top of being the owner of a gallery. Are you progressive?
I don't think anyone has a corner on the market in terms of owning that word, but with it comes, I think, that progressive attitude of creating changes that foster very much what Scott said in terms of values, ideas, and policies that can affect others and improve lives of others. So within my life and Terry's as well, we've both been involved in both art as well as politics and citizen advocacy, working within our unions as leaders, and also just within the community politically. And because Eau Claire has become such an exceptional place with a great quality of life and services, and we're kind of experiencing a renaissance, as many have said. You could say it's a rebirth of so much that is vital to the arts and to our culture locally, that it's just been a really cool place to be. And people have come together in ways that I don't think would always happen without the arts and without politics combined.
The voice of Joellen Burke. She is an artist and owner of 200 Main. That's a gallery in Eau Claire. Terry Myers with us. He's a visual artist of some impressive renown. They're in the studio with me. On the phone is Scott Ross, executive director. No relation, by the way. Executive, not that I know of, till I take that DNA test. Executive director of One Wisconsin Now and One Wisconsin Institute. We want to talk about the event to which you are coming. You're speaking there. You have a keynote address. It's a fundraiser. And first, Scott, do you have the opportunity to do a bunch of these around Wisconsin? And secondly, talk about people in the arts and what their partnership means to things and ideas that matter to you.
I am fortunate enough that I do get asked to come and speak to different groups all around the state of Wisconsin. I always try and bring something new, and I try and bring something enthusiastic, and I try and do it with as few swear words as possible. The idea of being able to partner with the arts community is just, you know, it's incredibly satisfying and rewarding for me. I had never intended on being in politics. I sort of embody that notion that says politics is show business for ugly people.
So is radio, by the way. Radio is that way, too, yeah.
would probably much rather have spent my time, you know, doing things that are an expression of myself rather than necessarily having to always be the wet blanket and say, yeah, but this bad thing is happening in politics right now. I always say you never should underestimate the intelligence of the people, but you don't want to overestimate their interest in politics. And sometimes people just start talking past each other rather than trying to have a conversation with each other. You know, we get into our camps. Obviously, we're divided as we never have been before, and it's going to take probably people, a lot of people in the arts community in particular, to sort of bring people back together and show more than anything else that we can all agree on some things like, one, you know, we all care about our families. Two, we all, you know, love a good laugh. And then three, art is the thing that has the ability to make us laugh, cry, be outraged. And maybe that's how we can create some of those bridges rather than walls.
The event that we're talking about is called Arts Activism and Creative Change. It is Saturday, the 21st of April. It's at the Clarion Hotel. That's in Eau Claire. Scott Ross's keynote address is called Citizen Activism and Cultural Transformation in Creating Thriving Communities. There are a lot more ingredients to the fundraiser, and Joe and Terry, you're my details.
Well, I think it's really a unique, first-of-its-kind event. Carol Craig and Patty Jarecki had approached me and asked if we could collect ideas and people within the community willing to support this event with donations of artwork, which can make many of us bristle a little because the artists in our community and elsewhere are very often asked to donate and they've been tapped out. But I think the respect for our artists in all realms in Eau Claire has gotten to be stronger and stronger. And so with the idea that they had to combine our sense of art, culture, community, and activism and change, we got together and were really gaining in our energy and excitement as we approached over 20 artists, every one of whom supports, as I found, the progressive ideals and seemed to appreciate what this meant beyond some simple fundraisers. So it's something to behold, what type of art, the artist's caliber, coming together to really coincide well with what Scott will talk about. It's an event that is a very exciting place to be on April 21st.
The event and the admission price includes dinner, social hour, engaging conversations, and a silent auction of those donated artist pieces. And, you know, other than it just being a gathering of like-minded people, Terry, what are the good time factors of this whole thing? I want to hear about that.
It's always a good time. We get to meet with people of our ilk. It's a coming together. It's a chance to laugh and
good
listen and
I wanted to hear the fact that there was going to be laughter.
There's always laughter.
I don't go anywhere where people don't laugh, okay? So wonderful stuff. Now, as I said at the top, we weren't going to be able to get all of the details in, and I hope that doesn't frustrate Joe and Terry. But for information or to view donated works of art, there is a website. Who wants to tell me what that is?
Well, that website is eauclairedemocrats.org. That is also the place they can purchase tickets as well as make bids. So bidding is open with photos of the artwork that include tremendous artists in the area. Andy Schaefer, Barb Schaefer, Dick Millhiser, Beverly Wickstrom, Terry Meyer, David Knowlton, Christy Skubin,
Joe
strong
Burke.
Artists as well.
Oh, really? Joe Burke's going to have some stuff. Twist your arm and got some stuff. Okay.
Absolutely.
The event, again, is April 21st. That's a Saturday. It begins at 5:30. Any idea where Scott's chat comes in? Is he going on right away, or is he going to hang out and eat some hors d'oeuvres and
that's
then talk?
What's
I think you'll have to come to find out.
That's a good point.
We've been in the studio with Joe Ellen Burke and Terry Meyer, and on the phone with Scott Ross, Executive Director, One Wisconsin Now, Arts Activism and Creative Change, annual fundraising event for Eau Claire County Democrats. Everybody, thank you so much.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun. In fact, the whole show fun. Well, every week. Are you kidding? We've got some room to tell you about some Spectrum memos. First, I want to remind you that next week we'll be talking with Washington Post White House reporter Ashley Parker, another luminary making her way our way. We'll have a first-hand preview of this year's Eau Claire Jazz Festival and music from featured headliners and more. That's coming up next week. Now, some Spectrum memoranda. A reception and book signing will take place next Friday, April 13th at the Farm Table Restaurant in downtown Amory, Wisconsin. The book is Loved and Loving, A Guide for Prayer by Jacqueline Bergen, I hope that's pronounced right, and Marie Schwann, Amory area residents. The book features original art by Amory artist Greg Rochester. Reception begins at 6 p.m. Details online at lovedandloving.net. Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts welcomes Lane Yost, who does a tribute to the music of John Denver. Saturday, April 14th, MabelTainter.org is that website. The Dunn County Barbershoppers present the 49th Annual Harmony Show this year, Hillbilly Harmony, Saturday evening, April 14th, in the Martin Anderson Gymnasium in Colfax. Visit online at dcbarbershop.org and on Facebook at Dunn County Barbershoppers. You've been meaning to get over to the Ellie Phillips Library in Eau Claire to check out Arts West 39. You better step on it. It's only up through tomorrow, Friday, if you're listening on Thursday, or today, if you're listening on Friday. That might be too late if you're listening on Friday. It's going to be a reading and a book signing for the book featured here a while back, Life Upon the Wicked Stage by Will Denson, Wednesday evening, April 18th, in the community room of Altoona Public Library. It's free and open to the public, starts at 7 o'clock. The Eau Claire Male Chorus Spring Sing and Dinner Concerts will be next Friday evening, April 13th, in the Eau Claire Regis High School Auditorium, and Saturday evening, the 14th, at the Masonic Ballroom on Graham Avenue in downtown Eau Claire. Reservations are required for the dinner concert. Here's a phone number. Are you ready? 715-835-7369. 715-835-7369. 6-9. Thanks, Hannah, Kate, Dean, plus you and you and you and you, our audience. You're the reason for being here. We wouldn't be here without you guys. If you promise to return next week, we'll be here too. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. See ya.